Hi, Susie.
Hi, Megan. How are you?
I'm fine. I guess we should start off by introducing
All
ourselves.
right.
I'm Megan McArdle of The Atlantic.
I'm Susie Kim at the Washington Post.
And I guess we're going to start off by talking about Occupy Wall Street, which I think you've been following a little bit more closely than me. So why don't you start off? What does this mean for America?
I think there are a couple of things that are pretty interesting. I mean, one, I think the overall kind of impetus for these protests and why they've spread so quickly is, just the general feeling of economic discontent. That the system hasn't, managed to solve any of the problems created by the financial crisis, and that our leaders in power generally, haven't been able to do enough. They've managed to enrich themselves while not making stuff much better. I mean, I think it was interesting because during the kind of protests that sprung up in Europe, in London and elsewhere of the summer, there was this question as to why this wasn't happening in the U.S. There are lots of young unemployed people. Their economic futures don't look great. Where's the anger? What's happening? And I think this is, pretty much at least part of the response to that. So, overall, I think that makes sense. I mean, I think the sort of interesting thing as more folks are paying attention is, folks in the mainstream media like myself, as they've often pointed out, have started paying attention, and as, sort of more institutions like labor unions, other folks on the left, are trying to figure out their role in this. I mean, to see how this will evolve, I think, is the uncertain thing. But I think it's not really a surprise to see that this has happened and see that it's kind of gained the momentum it has. What's been your kind of observation or thoughts so far?
Well, I'm not sure that this is actually yet an answer to why hasn't this happened here. I mean, we're talking about what on a Saturday, nice Saturday afternoon in New York, they got 1,000 people, maybe. So in general, I mean, this is a tiny protest. In college at a pro-choice march, which was literally, I think, maybe
Sure.
20 people. And of course, in Philadelphia, it's great because it's a very small media market. And so, what you could then do is you would go to a protest and you would run home and watch yourself on television. And they had filmed it in such a way as to imply that there were like hundreds or maybe thousands of women marching down, and there were 20 of us. They were just filmed like from different angles and so forth. It was all the same people. And so I've had some sense of that with Occupy Wall Street, is that, it's an interesting media hook. There's a lot of theatrics, and reporters, in some sense, have been waiting for this. But it's 1,000 people, right? This is smaller than like a rock concert in a not very large venue. And so it's hard to see this, and it's people who mostly have very low cost for their time because they're unemployed. And I don't mean to disparage their goals and motivations, et cetera. I'm in general sort of against protest. I think it's usually pretty ineffective. But aside from that, this is not a lot of people. It's not a mass movement. The Tea Party is far more, whatever you think of it, like an actual mass movement in terms of numbers of people who will show up anywhere than Occupy Wall Street. But it has some of the same characteristics. I mean, the Tea Party is the right-wing version of Occupy Wall Street. And in a lot of ways, the Tea Party is somewhat amorphous, right? They're against
Sure.
bailouts. They're against stimulus. But they don't have any sort of positive platform, really. And when they start developing one, the movement develops fractures. Similarly, this is 1,000 people who feel discontented, which is not an unreasonable way to feel right now. Who feel like bankers should have gotten a rawer deal than they did, which is not an unreasonable way to feel right now, and they showed up somewhere. But it's not any sort of a mass, the demonstrations in Greece and Spain especially, but even in London, are much larger, and more sort of rooted in an organized movement of having some sort of demands that I don't think you see here.
Well, I mean, I think so. I actually went by the so, so. I think a couple of things are sort of interesting about the way this has evolved. Agreed. It's a pretty. In fact, I think I was talking to I think it was Michael Kazin, I believe. But there have been actually far bigger demonstrations, focusing around the same issues in terms of, you know, holding Wall Street accountable, in terms of protesting sort of the foreclosure crisis, demonstrations that basically haven't gotten the same media attention that have been happening periodically in New York and Los Angeles, elsewhere, that just haven't had the same kind of, haven't managed to capture the same degree of media attention. I mean, I think, you know, the one thing that people are sort of questioning right now is, you know, oh, okay, well, you know, this might be a small group of people in New York, but, you know, can they form, I mean, I think the Tea Party more than anything was, you know, a kind of social network, you know, as you mentioned, that they could put out a call and then suddenly people would kind of materialize in very different parts of the country. And I think the strength of that movement was in the strength of that network and their ability to sort of mobilize in a very kind of disparate way. I'm not sure that that's here already. I mean, I think there are folks trying to lay the groundwork for that, sure, like definitely, in terms of having these kind of counter-protests parallel protests. I mean, when I went to the D.C., you know, offshoot of this, there were about maybe 20 people in McPherson Square Park. A couple of them had been there since, you know, Friday night. There was sort of hardcore votes. And other, I mean, the interesting thing about the D.C. Sort of manifestation of this, though, was that there were actually folks, you know, it wasn't just sort of activists and students and unemployed folks. It was also, you know, given that it's a D.C., political strategists, policy analysts, you know, folks who were sort of part of sort of the institutional left, that I think, you know, I mean, I think their hope and maybe part of the reason this has sort of gotten attention, you know, and the timing that it has is that, you know, they want to try to sort of channel this kind of more organized movement-oriented anger and energy that they feel like has been lost, you know, ever since Obama got elected and, you know, financial crisis, the economic crisis really hit. I think there's a real feeling, not just amongst the media, sort of wanting to find an object for this, but also sort of on, you know, in the institutional and sort of organized left, of wanting to feel like they can tap into some kind of mass mobilization. I mean, obviously the tension is that they, for the most part, you know, the institutional left still believes in organized politics. They still, you know, think that the 2012 elections matters, whereas many of these folks, you know, might be at the point where they're so disillusioned that they don't believe that political solution can provide any answers. And they don't think that either the Republicans or Democrats elected have done anything. But I think the overlap between the sort of Tea Party sentiments and you know, you've seen sort of Ron Paul supporters at these folks, you know, you've seen the protest the Fed. You know, I think there is a larger discontent that even people who may have supported the Tea Party, you know, they elected some conservative Republicans, they still haven't seen things change. I mean, I think it's sort of coming from both sides.
Yeah, but at the same time, I would say, you know, what the political activists ultimately want is to harness this for a coherent policy platform. And the thing that you've seen with the Tea Party, right, is that to the extent that they succeeded, the people who thought that they had control of this to make policy were sorely mistaken. Yeah. You know, a lot of people on the left have been excoriating John Boehner and, you know, how bad he is and how, you know, it's weird that he's become the focus for a lot of this ire over what's been happening in Congress, because the fact is John Boehner has no control over these people. No one does. And I watched this process where at first conservative leaders were really excited that they had this awesome negotiating chip. And then what they realized in the end was that it wasn't a negotiating chip, that they had unleashed a force over which they had no control. They couldn't bring it to heel when it was time to make a deal. And so, you know, that's the danger of something like this, is that the various things I've seen from these groups are like range from sort of the very vague and amorphous kind of it's not fair. And like a social movement whose argument is it's not fair never goes anywhere, right? Like civil rights had very discreet complaints that the government had the power to fix. I want you to stop, I want you to stop the lynchings. I want you to stop the legalized discrimination. I want you to stop me being forbidden to use white people's restrooms. I want my schools to be integrated, right? They had a very coherent list of demands that they could then mobilize their movement to achieve. Similarly, the anti-war protest, right? I want you, pulling out of Vietnam is something that is entirely in the government, is a discrete thing that the government can actually do. It can pull out of Vietnam. It's not fair is not something that the government can fix. Even, like, you're not fair is not something the government can really fix, because what does that mean, right?
Yeah.
Then, on the other hand side, there's the ludicrous, right? I want my student, a lot of people seem to be saying, I want my student loan debt forgiven. Well, the government's not going to forgive your student loan debt, and the reason the government isn't going to is the government's guaranteeing that debt, and it would cost the government a lot of money. So that's not going to happen. The government has already, in fact, gone out of its way to make student loan debt almost impossible to get out of. And they did that very deliberately to save the government money. So they're not going to now turn around and say, oh, well, look at all these billions of loans. I mean, it would be an immense amount of money. Can you imagine if they just decided to forgive student loan debt? I mean, not only would this hose everyone who has paid into the system, right? You know, the people who are halfway through their student loans only get half the forgiveness of the people. Or are we going to start writing checks to everyone retroactively for their student loans? I mean, I'd be happy with that. I'd get a $100,000 check from the government for the business school loans that I paid off. But I don't think that realistically this is going to happen. You would create massive unfairness, massive kind of distributional issues, because it would overwhelmingly go to affluent people. And so they have – what I haven't seen is any sort of – something the government has the power to do – would be in any way likely to do that wouldn't create more problems than it would solve. And I mean, obviously you can argue pulling out of Vietnam might have created more problems, but you know, that would actually have some realistic chance of passing, of getting majority support or quasi-majority support, close to majority support, something that could be done. And so I find it, to the extent that they actually managed to grow this thing, what I suspect is, I'm skeptical that that will happen, but even if they did, what they would end up is the Tea Party. And, you know, honestly, you ask Republican leadership, they're not so happy. You know, they're kind of still glad that it's forcing choices, that, you know, some choices they would like to see made, but they're also afraid of this monster that they've created.
Yeah. I mean, I think there are a couple of things there. I mean, I think that's first of all, I mean, this is the reason that folks like labor unions, folks, you know, progressive organizers that do have specific policy ideas. I mean that specifically, you know, maybe support President Obama's deficit reduction plan that would raise taxes on the wealthy, that would eliminate you know, some of these you know, very that have actual specific policy ideas tied to their agenda. I mean, the question, I mean, I think that the question, and maybe they wouldn't want it posed this way, is, you know, can they co-opt any of this energy? Can you know, at least some of these folks who, or at least some of this discontent, you know, can it be sort of put in their direction, and you know, can they sort of benefit the way that you know, sort of conservative groups that had been around for a long time, you know, Club for Growth, Freedom Works, so on and so forth, you know, kind of managed to direct that Tea Party energy into electing, you know, pretty maybe more conservative than usual, but, you know, basically Republican candidates. I'm not sure that, given how dissatisfied, you know, at least at that point, they could say, well, Republicans have been in power, give us a chance. And now, you know, sort of given the liberal disillusionment with Obama, with, you know, sort of associating Obama, whether fairly or not, with the state of the economy, that the left will be able to do the same. I mean, I think the other question is, I think you're right. I mean, there's a lot that, in terms of the state of the economy, that is basically, you know, not only the government has a limited role, that the U.S. has almost sort of no leverage. And I mean, you know, take the Eurozone crisis, for instance, which is definitely going to at least stall, if not worsen, kind of our state of the state of the economy right now. This isn't something that the U.S. government can fix. I mean, the U.S. government, you know, we can sort of urge certain solutions, and the U.S. Geithner and sort of IMF are trying to urge a certain course of action. But this is something, I mean, I guess it is this feeling that it of sort of powerlessness. And, you know, we'd like to blame certain actors, you know, corporate greed, whatever have you, for, you know, for the state of affairs, but this is something that at this point has kind of spiraled outside of our own control. And I think, you know, it's difficult, to kind of explain that to folks. And I don't think, you know, members of Congress, you know, want to say, well, you know, hey, there's not really anything we can do here. You know, Europe is dragging us down. Well, for the foreseeable future. I mean, that's not something that any sort of leader in power wants to say, that in fact, there are limits to what they can do. And that's just going to, you know, be kind of a crappy situation for a while.
Yeah, what's interesting to me is that the focus has always, in the U.S., has always been so focused on America. And you watch Europe unfolding. I mean, this whole narrative of how Bush drove the economy into a ditch. Like, did he drive Germany's economy into a ditch, too? Yeah. Did he drive everyone else's economy? Like, Mr. Men, the most immensely powerful U.S. president ever. In fact, like, there was a global crisis that didn't have a whole lot to do with, like, specific Republican policies or, indeed, any other specific policy. This is something that, like, seems to have been about 3 decades in the making, as far as I can tell, maybe more. And you can argue it all started with the collapse of Bretton Woods in, I think, 1974, I want to say, they closed the gold window. I should know that off the top of my head. That's embarrassing. But I'm elderly now, so I forget things easily. I think that, you know, the Occupy Wall Street is still very U.S. focused when the main action is no longer taking place in the U.S. right now, I think. But I would also, I would just go back and say that two things. First of all, I'm basically an economic determinist. I don't think Occupy Wall Street is going to help the Democrats take Congress. The fact is, Occupy Wall Street is not going to overcome. If unemployment is at 9%, if real GDP growth is basically stalled, if median incomes are still depressed to the levels that they are now, like, Occupy Wall Street could be the most awesome, effective grassroots movement ever, and President Obama is probably still going to lose re-election. The Democrats are probably still going to possibly lose the Senate, lose more seats in the House. And you're going to get a wave that's going to put Republicans in, because unfortunately that's what happens to the people who happen to be in charge when things go wrong. I had a really interesting conversation with David Kennedy, who's written this great book, Freedom from Fear, about the Great Depression, which I highly recommend to everyone. And he talked about the fact that, in fact, Hoover faced this incredibly obstructionist Democratic Congress, which people have now forgotten. The Democrats basically ran out the clock, and Hoover would come up with ideas that could have made things better, and the Democrats would be like, not happening on our watch. Because they knew that the worse things got, the better they would do in the 1932 elections. And they were right. I mean, it was completely rational. And the fair thing that he said, and said, you know, you can also say about the Tea Party, is they didn't necessarily understand what they were doing. They didn't understand how bad things were. I don't think that it's necessarily going to – I don't think there's any grassroots solution to that fundamental dilemma. They're not going to reelect Obama because a bunch of people – who were already really, really, really disaffected with the Republican Party, got a little more motivated. I mean, you're talking about marginal gains here. The second, because, I mean, this is what we now know about the Tea Party, right? These are people who are basically conservative. There were all these narratives about how these people had never participated in politics before, and it's not true. The people who like to participate in politics are people who like to participate in politics. And yes, there was always some housewife in Ohio who just got fed up and marched out. But in general, the people who are at Occupy Wall Street, I guarantee this is not their first demonstration. Did you go to demonstrations in college?
Yes, I did go to demonstrations in college. I went to a lot of stuff. Yep.
And the fact is, they were all the same people, right? You showed up at the environmental protest, you could see all your friends from the pro-choice protest, and you went to ACT UP demonstration, and there were some of the other people from... people who do that sort of thing are a very specific kind of people, and there aren't that many of them. And that was true. This is true of the Tea Partiers, and I assume it's going to be true of this, is simply that. But second of all, that even if this were true, even if you managed to put in a bunch of Occupy Wall Street, or maybe it'll get a better name, because I feel like that's kind of a weird name. Even Tea Party is a little strange, but Occupy Wall Street is a very strange name for, like, your grassroots movement. But say that that's, you know, call it OWS, gets a bunch of candidates in. What they found with the Tea Party is that initially leadership thought that they had these people who would threaten to shut down government, and they'd be like, oh, they're crazy. We really need, like, another billion, you know, another $500 billion in tax cuts before we can make, shut them down, right, to sweeten it for them. And what they found out was that these people had, in fact, been elected to shut down the government. That was their mandate. And so it wasn't a strategy. They were totally happy to shut down the government. Similarly, if you elect a bunch of people whose mandate is to dismantle the system, they're going to start dismantling the system, and they're going to insist that you do it. And Democratic leadership, for I think very good reasons, doesn't actually want to start like nationalizing the coal mines or whatever it is that in the end they would demand as their price for going along with leadership. So I'm not sure that it would be like on any level a happy thing for the Democrats to actually get this, have this coalition get them into office, because I think the Republicans would have picked up a bunch of seats anyway. If it hadn't been for the Tea Party, Republicans would still, they would have picked up, in fact, two seats that they lost, two Senate seats that they lost because of the Tea Party. People were mad at the Democrats because the economy was crappy and all the stuff that they didn't like about George Bush, a lot of it still seemed to be happening in terms of foreign policy and so forth. And mostly the economy was crappy, and they were mad about that. And they didn't like the stimulus because they don't like big amorphous government programs that are, you know, sort of that sound bad. And so they were going to elect a bunch of Republicans. So I'm not sure how much the Tea Party helped. It actually like created this kind of angry force. Similarly, if the Democrats are in a good position to take this stuff back, how much edge would something like Occupy Wall Street really give them? Or would it instead do things like the primary challenge that returned Joe Lieberman to office, right? Would it do things like, knocking out candidates who leadership can deal with in favor of candidates who leadership can't, and actually make it harder to get any sort of coherent agenda done?
Yeah, I mean, I think more than sort of the folks who are sort of literally out on the streets kind of organizing, you know, the folks, I guess, it's sort of a mixture of both sort of more conventional liberal Democrats or just sort of liberal move-on types with, you know, kind of the anti-globalization anarchists blow up the system types who you kind of seen at many protests over the last decade, two decades, so forth. I mean, I think, you know, it's sort of interesting to see this bubble up, whatever it may be or may represent, kind of at the same time that Obama has tried to take, you know, taken more of this kind of populist tone and sort of tack, not only kind of putting out this deficit reduction package that sort of made it clear that he was going to run, as folks kind of expected in 2012, on raising taxes on the wealthiest folks, on eliminating tax breaks for corporations, that sort of thing. I mean, I think, you know, at least the hope, if there's any, I agree with you sort of bottom line that the state of the economy will determine the outcome of the election more than any other single factor. I mean, I think, you know, it's sort of what we saw in 2010. I think they'll just sort of be a repeat version of that this time around. And, you know, maybe there'll be more disillusionment with amongst some. Maybe I know that there's already been sort of talk that some of those Tea Party freshmen that were elected in, they have no definite chance that they'll be reelected either. I mean, that they, you know, whether it was failing to turn the economy around in the ways they'd hope, or not actually shutting down the government, or making all the budget cuts that they promised, you know, there's still folks who are sort of fed up with them. There'll be sort of disillusionment on both sides, but it'll definitely, the economy still hangs on Obama. But, I mean, I think at least, you know, from the Obama campaign's perspective is that, you know, listen, there's discontent out there. It's because, some folks are way more privileged than others. They've managed, even folks who were sort of at the heart of causing this financial crisis are still, you know, sort of managing to ride it out just fine, and that, you know, they should be paying more of their share. I mean, I think it's sort of interesting. I mean, whether those folks, you know, whether the folks actually occupying Wall Street would actually, you know, sort of be mobilized to re-elect Obama. I mean, I kind of am sort of highly skeptical of that direct effect. But in terms of the bigger narrative, in terms of trying to tap into this feeling of discontent and feeling that the system is unfair, but at least, you know, here's one guy who's willing to point that out and it sort of has, has many of the same ideas about who's responsible in terms of the villains. I mean, in terms of that narrative, I mean, at least, you know, if the Obama campaign is going to sort of run on anything, I think it seems increasingly clear that's going to be the way to go. As to whether that will be effective in terms of turning, in terms of actually reelecting him, I think that's another question. But it sort of seems, it's sort of interesting to see how these two things have kind of overlapped at the same time.
I think in general, I've been kind of interested in watching the Obama administration, like what they've been doing, what they've decided to do in the last month. Mm-hmm. And I take it there's kind of two possible explanations for what they're doing, right? Because they've clearly decided that the way that they're going to win is by moving left.
Yeah.
They're going to be the guy, Obama's going to be the guy out there. I think he's made some radical missteps. I think doing things like saying, well, Republicans are making it all about me. In fact, like, you're the one who's making it all about you. They haven't mentioned you. You may think that they're making it all about you. That might be entirely fair, but they've actually got, however crappy BS reasons you think they are, they're stating reasons for opposing your policies. They're not saying, like, I personally dislike Barack Obama, therefore I'm voting against blah. And so I think that was kind of a misstep, but there's a more interesting, broader strategy of being the guy who's going out there and saying, like, the rich are stacking the system against you. We're going to take it back. Because it's all, you know, as soon as everyone started saying, like, this is the Obama we've been waiting for, and he continued falling in the polls. There were a lot of pundits who've been waiting to hear this. There were a lot of progressive activists who've been waiting to hear this, and they're really excited. It hasn't done anything for his approval rating, nor did, as far as I can tell, is the Jobs Act. And so it's all base motivation, right? And Axelrod has been saying things like, well, you know, we've got all this, these states you didn't necessarily think we could be competitive in, we're going to take it there. And it's like, that kind of sounds like the normal thing you would do is you're pretty sure it's not going to work, so now you're going to try something kind of risky and desperate. So that's the unkind way of putting it. And the kind way is that, you know, like, look, all of these Republicans are going to be tacking right and then trying to move back to the center during the primary season, so why shouldn't the president do the same thing? He can tack left, and then when it comes time to debate Mitt Romney or whoever ends up being the guy in charge, he can tack back to the center and start making kind of more centrist noises. I don't know which of these is true. I mean, I suspect that the White House is panicking a little just from things like what Axelrod is saying and the fact that regardless of anything, there's a radical change in strategy for him. But I don't know whether this is part of like a grander strategy to kind of try to recapture the center in June of next year, or whenever the regular campaign season starts, or whether he's just going to try to ride an angry and motivated base all the way back to the White House.
Yeah, I mean, I think there is definitely, I mean, I agree with you that I don't think sort of, you know, deal making, sort of centrist, reasonable, independently minded Obama has gone away. I think it's definitely, you know, we'll sort of wait and see when he'll come back. I think definitely by the point of the general election, I don't think he's sort of killed off that part of his persona. I mean, I wonder in terms of, I mean, I think part of the reason that progressives and so forth, you know, the sort of the base folks are so excited, you know, I mean, there's this kind of very popular idea, I think, on the left that you know, Obama hasn't succeeded because he hasn't been enough a leader. You know, he hasn't put out the kind of bold progressive ideas that they're looking for. Even if he does believe in them, he always has kind of presented himself as, you know, well, listen, let's all gather on the table and we'll come up with a reasonable solution. We'll take some Republican ideas, Democratic ideas, so on and so forth. That they were sort of really tired of that. I mean, I think, you know, the real problem is, I mean, whatever Obama's message is, and it's become clear that, you know, there's no, you know, his agenda doesn't have a chance in the current Congress. I mean, that the current Congress is going to pass his entire Jobs Act. There, you know, I mean, the question as to whether they can just fulfill the day-to-day functions of to keep government running, you know, I mean, that's become the kind of new low bar that they've managed to cross. I mean, I think what Obama is trying to offer is a promise that, well, you know, reelect me and, you know, maybe Congress will change too and we'll actually get something done. I mean, I wonder to what degree.
But here's the thing. He can't even get the Jobs Act to Democrats, right? He doesn't have enough of people on his own side to even bring this thing to the floor.
No, I know, but I wonder, much less the Republicans. Mm-hmm. I mean, in terms of his approval ratings, I mean, you know, his approval ratings are low, but those for Congress are even lower. And I wonder whether the public kind of finally realizes that, you know, no one's really going to fix, you know, whether it's Obama or Congress, like, you can't, that there's just this kind of impotency. And, you know, Obama might say, well, it's because of structures, Republicans and so forth, but I'm not sure that he's going to be able to kind of say that. I mean, you know, he can put out his plan and say, well, the reason, I mean, this is his hope, right? That I guess is one of the only things he could do at this point, is say, well, you know, well, the baseline assumption, nothing substantial is really going to pass. So I might as well put my sort of big, bold liberal plan out and sort of draw a distinction between myself and the Republicans who are going to vote anything that I do down, just to make that distinction more clear. I'm not sure whether voters are going to be able to kind of buy that argument that you know, Obama could do his job if it weren't for the Republicans sort of getting in the way. I'm not sure that distinction is going to be sort of made clear in the elections next year, even if that's, you know, part of the strategy in terms of his attempt to you know, move left, at least for the sake of having something that he said that he's trying to run, you know, sort of stand for, and, you know, kind of assume the voters will understand there's a reason that he hasn't been able to, you know, sort of pass the things that he wants to do.
It worked for Truman with the Do Nothing Congress, but it didn't work for Hoover, and Truman had a better economy than Hoover did. You know, I mean, I think that ultimately there's a point at which I think Obama is now regretting, and I don't know why he did it exactly. And maybe he didn't have a choice. So, like, I think he's in a crappy situation. I think we probably both agreed that, you know, guy just got elected to office the wrong year. But his line was, for 3 years, Republicans drove the economy into the ditch. I'm going to drive it back out. No, we can't give them the keys. Can't trust them. They drove into the ditch. It's all their fault. I'm going to fix it. He couldn't fix it. And that wouldn't be a problem if he hadn't promised us that the only reason the economy was in a ditch was that Republicans were in charge, and that the fix to that was to have Democrats in charge. And so, you know, my old boss used to say, he let his mouth write checks, his ass couldn't cash. And I understand the political reasons to do it, but I think you can argue it put him in an even worse place than had he said at the beginning of, like, you just come out, like, in March at some point and been like, this is much worse than we thought. Until we had access to all the data, we couldn't really see. This is going to take years. Frankly, it's very likely that in 2012, we're going to be facing a terrible economy. And this is just, you're going to have to spend years rebuilding this, and it's going to be really difficult to get out. And he didn't say that. He said, I can fix this, and it's all their fault. And the reason I can fix this is that I'm not them. And so I think, like, you can argue he put himself in a war. I don't know, though, because, I mean, frankly, like, if he'd said that, would people have given him, you know, would that have helped? Or would they have just been like, why are you so crappy? Why can't you fix it? Like the Republican candidate who totally says he can fix it. I don't know.
Well, I mean, that comes with the inherent problem of, you know, I mean, of the danger of asking, of running on a campaign that's asking voters, well, you know, like back in 2008, you know, are you better off than you were, you know, a year ago, 2 years ago, whenever. Now he's setting himself up for voters to ask the same question. And you know, that you know, Democrats can try to kind of re-explain things. But I think, I mean, I mean, it wasn't that long ago that, I think part of the reason that the Obama campaign has kind of shifted gears to sort of this populist tactic so quickly and is that, you know, it wasn't that long ago that it did look like things were at least turning around a little bit, that things didn't look as bad as they were. I mean, I'm not sure to what degree, you know, so the White House was aware of that or sense that coming, but didn't really want to sort of shift gears politically yet or what. But, I mean, I think, you know, overall things are, I mean, no one expected things to be great, but I think things are definitely worse. And for reasons that are, you know, as we kind of discussed earlier, largely outside the U.S.'s own control in terms of what's happening in Europe, in terms of, you know, sort of the post-earthquake Japan kind of recovery. There's a lot of stuff that has nothing to do with the U.S., but, you know, has I think, made this job, the job all the harder, I mean, both to government and for Obama to be reelected.
And the first scandals are hitting, which is, there's been a sort of interesting lesson for me, and like I had an exchange with Eric Kane, who blogs at Forbes, about Solyndra, where he said, I mean, there was like this ridiculous Media Matters piece where they were like, there was this scandal at the Minerals Management Service in September that came out in 2008. And Minerals Management Service, as I'm sure you know, and like anyone who's been watching news, the Department of the Interior is just like a raucously screwed up government agency. And the reason it's screwed up is that it's got so much valuable stuff that it disperses to private actors at like practically zero cost. And that leads to the obvious incentive problems, employees who rotate in and out on a revolving door, and like all of the any problem that you can imagine would be created by that situation has actually just existed in Interior for like 100 years.
Oh, this was the lobbyists and right. The cocaine and all that sort of stuff. Yeah. Yeah.
But that said, it was September of 2008, and the media was a mite busy with some other stuff going on, like an election and a financial crisis. And so Media Matters was like, look at all the mentions of Solyndra, and then look at all the mentions of this Mineral Management Services scandal. It's like, really? Why? Yeah, I can't imagine why they stopped covering the total meltdown of world financial markets to comment on some employee at Mineral Management Services who was doing cocaine. And so, there's a lot of money involved. I don't want to in any way seem to excuse scandals at Mineral Management Service, but this is a long-standing problem that they've had for decades. I mean, like Teapot Dome, I believe, was actually a Mineral Management, a Department of the Interior scandal. This was the scandal, by the way, that for readers who are not perhaps as versed in presidential lore as Washington wonks have to be, this was the scandal that kind of killed Warren Harding. Most people think he died of... his health deteriorated radically as this scandal was brewing, and then it broke posthumously. So he went from being kind of like an okay president to retrospectively being known as one of the worst presidents ever because of this huge scandal that occurred with some of the boys from Ohio that he had appointed to various federal offices. Anyway, back to Mineral Management. So Media Matters had written this ridiculous piece, and Eric Kane and I were kind of talking about it in the comments of his blog. And he said, well, you know, Katrina didn't hit Bush till the end of his presidency. And I was like, it didn't. It hit him. Like, it hit him at the moment when he started to look weak, right? And there's a thing about scandals is that somehow, I think if Solyndra had broken a year and a half ago, it would have been nothing. Right, and there's this actually like arguably worse issue with something called Gunwalker, where the ATF, for reasons that are still completely unclear to me, was selling guns to Mexican drug cartels. Anyway, but it didn't really stick because it broke a while ago. And this one, on the other hand, broke at kind of exactly the right time. Obama looks really weak. This plays into, in the same way that Katrina played into, Republicans don't care about government. They don't want to do even the things that government should do, right? This plays into Democrats just like to ship money out the door to random stuff that makes happy sounds to their environmental group constituencies, whether or not they're a good idea or not. It comes when the president looks weak and when it bolsters something we already kind of believe about, stereotypically about that president for some reason. That's a bad sign. It's a very bad sign when people start piling on these things because it feeds this perception that the president is going down. And, you know, like, if you think about Bill Clinton, by contrast, it took something of the magnitude of DNA on a dress that that belonged to a girl who he'd lied under oath about having sexual relations with, right? Had it not been at that level of proof, it wouldn't have gone anywhere. And so that's another kind of, I think, bad sign, and we can talk about Solyndra and, you know, what this means for administration policy or what we should do about energy policy in a minute. But I think it also, if you look at what that means for the presidency, it's kind of a bad marker. But you don't know. I mean, the fact is, like, all of the stuff that we're worried about in Europe could basically resolve itself, and we could have 4% growth, you know, next spring. You just, like, all of this stuff, all economic forecasting to some extent is just mindless trend extrapolation. So, and the trends don't keep on going forever. So for all we know, this is all going to be moot, and Obama's going to cruise to re-election with a great economy. It's totally, it looks less and less likely, but if a big growth spike happens, if unemployment really starts turning around, this could all be completely, I think, moot discussion, but.
Yeah, and well, I mean, I feel like I'm becoming more and more skeptical that things are just very, sort of an incremental way that Europe is trying to deal with is incrementally looking worse, worse and worse. But anyway, I mean, I think I agree that it's definitely a political hit, when Obama sort of is vulnerable in terms of the Solyndra stuff. I mean, I think part of the reason also, though, is that, and I kind of tied this back to the fact that the sort of comprehensive energy overhaul never really went anywhere. We didn't really have that debate in any kind of full-fledged way because it died. And I think it's, in terms of the Democratic response to this on the Hill, I mean, you know, you sort of had, you sort of saw this kind of operationalized in terms of the last kind of government shutdown fight. And the sort of threat looming overhead that the Republicans kind of insisted on this offset for disaster aid, but the offset specifically targeted, these loan guarantee programs, the one that sort of backs Solyndra, as well as one going to clean car companies. And the Democratic response to this, at least initially, actually had very little to do with justifying why the government needs to support clean energy. I mean, their sort of number one justification of this was that it creates jobs. That was the narrative. I mean, I sort of understand the logic behind, sort of wanting to stay on the narrative, being, okay, we need to create jobs. The government can have some role in doing that. If we eliminate these loan guarantees, all these jobs go away. But there hasn't really been the chance for, I think that part of the reason that Obama has sort of been so vulnerable on this issue is because Democrats haven't had a chance to kind of totally, this hasn't been an issue that they've put at the center of their agenda. And that was a decision that, Obama decided to go with healthcare instead of energy or any immigration, any number of other things. But, that's sort of the sense that I get that it's vulnerable because we haven't had this debate and that in terms of sort of the public's understanding of this, I mean, no one's really made, the full-fledged case to them, Democrats or anyone else, for, why we need a carbon tax, for instance, and why in the absence of that, maybe we need government subsidies or other sort of, support for the clean energy, for clean energy development. And I think, for that reason, I think it sort of is an issue that is a politically tempting target and one that, we'll see. It's, with all these, how long any scandal lasts at this point, I mean, given kind of the speed of the political cycle and the media cycle, I don't really know. I mean, this could seem like it happened 3 years ago by the time, right, election rolls around. But
oh, no, I don't think, like, let me be clear. I do not think that Solyndra, unless there is some, like, smoking gun, right? If someone comes out with a letter in which, like, Obama or one of his high-level cabinet secretaries, but preferably Obama, writes a note to George Kaiser and is like, don't worry, I know this is a terrible idea, but I have instructed the Department of Energy to issue this loan anyway. Short of that, I think it's really unlikely that that this takes down the president. I just meant, like, as a signal. People ignore stuff when the president seems strong, and when he seems weak, scandals seem like they might have more salience. And in the weird way, the media covers stories because they might be stories. It's like the inverse of, remember Obama's bowling score? Where, like, and this became a story because it was good on video, right? Like, no one really thought, no one in the media, I got so many complaints about this mostly from progressives, but, like, so many people in the media were like, how are we covering Obama's bowling score? And it was like, no one in the media thought he might get into a bowl-off with Vladimir Putin for the fate of the Western world. Therefore, we'd better know, right? Is he going to be able to win for America? It was that it made, it was like a nice little video clip. And so a lot of TV networks ran it because it was a good clip, right? And TV just loves anything that's visual in a way that most presidential campaign events are not. Mostly it's just people talking, which is kind of boring. And then, but here's the thing, like, it might be important, right? People might like him better because he's a good bowler, or not like him well because of his bowling. And therefore, like, people started writing it up because they thought maybe it would affect the campaign. And then the TV networks were like, oh, this must be an important story. We should run more of it. And that's a, you know, you have a little bit of that, right? It's like, Solyndra might be important because what if it makes people mad? Therefore, I'd better write a lot about it. And then, of course, people get mad because you write a lot about it. But I, you know, like, I think, so I think there's part of that. I don't think it's necessarily going to play a huge role in the campaign, but I do think that it kind of tarnishes the image. And while I agree with you that they haven't really made a case for this, and partly, like, they didn't come up with the idea of issuing loan guarantees. This was actually, like, a pre-existing program. I will, full disclosure, like, I think, A, loan guarantees in general are a terrible way of doing policy. I think there's actually three separate debates here, and the administration's actually not prepared to have any of them, in part because some of them are hard debates to have in public where you're trying to do this in like 30-second sound bites. Mm. There's the debate over, first of all, whether we should be subsidizing clean energy. And I think that you can make, as a lot of Greens have done in the last couple weeks, as Solyndra has become more of an issue, you can say, look, we all know as wonks that we'd prefer a carbon tax. I'm in favor of a carbon tax. I presume you're in favor of a carbon tax. The second best to that might be cap and trade, but we didn't get that either. So maybe third best is we've got to subsidize solar panels. And that's one debate. A second debate, and I might not sure how I feel about subsidizing. And I wouldn't do it as solar panels, but I might, you know, be in favor of saying, well, if we really can't do these things, okay, we're going to do something else that somehow lowers the price of anything that's, you know, has a net negative carbon footprint or whatever, or a net much lower carbon footprint than normal fossil fuels. Second question is, if we're going to do it, how should we do it? And I think, to me, I'm against loan guarantees. I'm against them. First of all, DOE does these for all sorts of, they don't just do them for Solyndra. They do them for coal plants and nuclear plants, et cetera. And with the possible exception of nuclear plants, which is a very strange area where the regulatory burden is such that it's not possible to comply, no one would fund these things simply because the liability and the regulatory problems are so large. And you can argue that's actually like a government-induced market failure that then maybe we have to correct. Aside from that, that one possible exception, and I'm not real sure about that exception, I don't think loan guarantees are a good way to do something. And the argument is, first of all, that you have to get these firms through what manufacturing calls the valley of death, where there's a lot of money for kind of initial development, but not necessarily for getting to scale where you're... I'm kind of skeptical of the valley of death, I have to say. The valley of death seems to emerge mostly from complaints about manufacturers that no one wants to fund their crap. And I haven't seen a lot of great evidence that you can consistently, rather than cherry picking one or two stories, you can always cherry pick one or two stories that will make some policy sound right. But rather than cherry picking one or two stories, I haven't seen any evidence that consistently it's not possible to get manufacturing up to scale here cost effectively. So I don't really see the need for the government to get in the business of building factories. Especially because factories already exist, and Solyndra had in fact managed to build one, had managed to lease a facility and then fill it with machines, absent a United States loan guarantee. But also, like, it's seen by people as a way of, well, we've only got $5 billion to spend, and we're going to make it go farther by doing loan guarantees, which means that we only have to, you know, we only have to account for that $5 billion as our estimated default risk. So say we do $100 billion, we think the default risk is 5%, we can do $100 billion in loan guarantees. I think there's a bunch of problems with this. First of all, it's a way of gaming the Congressional Budget Office process of scoring because the CBO doesn't have any idea how many solar panel companies are going to fail. Right? There's no like good estimates of that. They're just kind of, they have to, and I don't fault them. There's just no way to know. They have to take a guess. Second of all, like, it's a lot easier with the other stuff they do, where they're, you know, like some sort of natural gas plant. You can, aside from the price of the natural gas, you can basically estimate that, like, there's going to be continuing demand for natural gas. With solar with manufacturing solar panels, it's a whole different issue, right? We don't know how much it costs. We don't know whether it's ever going to cost anything that will cause people to buy them, how many people are going to buy them. We're trying to get private industry to do something. It's completely different from, like, a regulated utility, which is where a lot of these other loans go. So that's one of the problems. First of all, you're introducing leverage, and they talk about this. We're going to leverage private investment. Well, yeah, leveraged investments then have downside as well as upside. So yes, if you estimate that your default risk is 5%, you get $100 billion. And one of my commenters, I posted this today, had a really good summary of this. And he points out, like, look, one way to look at this is that Solyndra was only 3% of the total portfolio of loan guarantees, and it's an outlier, and that this is just like a VC portfolio, and you have some failures, but overall it's a great idea. Another way to look at it is that their expected failure rate, say it was 6%, I'm just making up this number for, you know, illustrative purposes. Okay, well, half of their expected failures have already occurred. And it doesn't take much to put them in the category where this is costing a lot more than it was projected. So with loan guarantees, you have a big potential to blow through your budget by a lot, because estimating a default risk on something like a solar panel manufacturing entity is inherently just very difficult to do. The second issue, it's a way of making it look cheaper, right? But it's taking advantage of peculiarities of government accounting. The other thing is that everyone's been saying, well, the government has to ask it, act as a VC because it's too risky. And it's just not true. Like, the private markets can cope with both risk and scale. They can put together big loan syndicates. They can do equity instead of, if you can't make it work with a loan, you do an equity sale instead. We funded huge companies full of server farms and so forth that required immense amounts of capital, and we didn't do it with government loans. And so I find this, like, that part of it. If you want to subsidize solar panels, then subsidize solar panels or carbon, low carbon, you know, they're not totally carbon free, obviously, because you have to manufacture them, but very low, let's call them very low carbon solutions. If you want to do that, we should subsidize that, because think of it this way. Right now with Solyndra, we have a factory that consumed resources and carbon in building it. And we have warehouses full of solar panels that are apparently very hard to sell. Because there's no manufacturer to warranty them, and no one really knows how they'll perform. Had we subsidized a solar panel installation, we would have a lot of solar panel installations, which is what we wanted, right? We at least theoretically shouldn't really care whether Solyndra exists or not. We should care whether there are many solar panels installed, lowering the carbon imprint of our electric grid. And so with direct subsidies, you're at least only paying for the thing that you actually want to subsidize. With loan guarantees, you're paying for a whole lot of intermediate stuff that the market can handle if the market for the end product is there. And so, you know, if you need to subsidize it, create a market for the end product. Do not go in and start trying to pick corporate winners and losers, because aside from everything else, you might pick technology wrong. You're going to mobilize, there's evidence that these loan guarantees mobilize a lot of private capital to follow the loan guarantee, right? So you've now actually, like, distorted the market further. But also, you're vulnerable to all of this sort of, well, there's fundraisers, and how was this decision made? When you start making those choices, you erode trust in the system. And I think that, you know, and I think that that's true. You know, Greens have been rightly complaining that oil and gas, that all sorts of these loan guarantees also exist for non-clean tech facilities, and they shouldn't. I mean, does anyone really think that you couldn't build a natural gas-fired power plant if it weren't for DOE loan guarantees, that we would just go without electricity rather than build those plants? No, that is ridiculous. So the issue is the end market. The issue is not, you know, the ability to actually, like, put bricks and mortar together. The market, as we saw with the housing bubble, knows how to do that really well. So, and Solyndra rant, I apologize. That was somewhat lengthy.
No, having read your blog post, your coverage of this, no, I
somewhat exhaustive.
I can understand. you know, why you want to sort of outline. I mean, I agree that it's sort of a multifaceted problem, and obviously, you know, the problem when it becomes a political football is that we kind of ignore, you know, all that sort of stuff gets lost, and it just becomes either or. I think there are a couple of things that I think are interesting. I mean, one in terms of you know, the fact that the underlying problem is that there just isn't. We need more demand for basically everything. I mean, solar panels included, and that, I mean, I think the problem with some of these interventions is that it's ultimately not going to be a substitute for that, and that, you know, whether it's a solar industry or really any other industry, that's, you know, however else we choose to support or intervene, if there's no consumer demand, factory demand, so forth, that's, you know, nothing, none of these fixes are going to be sustainable. I mean, I think one thing is interesting, I mean, as you sort of pointed out, I know you pointed that out earlier, and I think that's part of the reason that it's there. I mean, that seems maybe very obvious, but you know, the reason that we haven't kind of hashed out the different alternatives is that because it would have been extremely difficult to do so, to actually convince, right, you know, that Congress that an alternative to this would be better, and a sort of better use of government resources and so forth. I mean, I think the fact that it's there is at least something more than, I mean, I think there were some, you know, subsidies and sort of tax breaks to solar and wind, some of which came through the stimulus. But, I mean, I think the sort of ongoing problem with that is that they could keep expiring, and that there's no kind of longer, you know, there's no certainty there. And folks are looking for, you know, whether their private investors or you know, sort of government folks deciding which companies to support, that they're looking for. I mean, this is part of the reason that that these sort of alternative energy markets haven't been picking up in the ways that some folks would like them to be doing. So I think that's part of the problem. So I think the other thing, what was it? What else was I going to point out? No, I mean, I think in terms of the appeal of, I mean, I think that there is this kind of appeal, at least coming from Democrats, let's say, who want to support such efforts of, you know, saying, pointing to the fact that, oh, you know, we helped build this factory, it created these jobs, that there's sort of an incentive politically in terms of being able to say that, well, you know, the government helped this happen, this and so forth, rather than be like, well, you know, we helped the market by increasing demand, by subsidizing solar panels in this kind of way, that I think, politically speaking, I can sort of understand why the Democratic sort of defense of this has sort of come the way that it has. But I mean, I'm wondering, I mean, do you sort of see any corners of either sort of Republicans or sort of conservative policy types actually kind of hashing this out? I mean, I think the problem is that the, you know, when these issues get raised, they just get politicized, and then actually kind of figure out reasonable alternatives just gets totally lost. But I'm wondering whether maybe you're picking up on more of that kind of dialogue than I am.
Well, I think that there's a bunch of different strands in the criticism, right? There's the people who are just like, oh, something bad happened. Obama was in charge. That is excellent. There are people like me who are like just kind of randomly fascinated by this as, first of all, I hate loan guarantees at all. I also deliver long diatribes about co-signing. I hate them in all walks of life. It's not just a federal government thing. I really, really think that guaranteeing a loan is always a way to hide from yourself the actual cost of doing it. And people think it's free, and it's really, really not free. So that's like sort of aside. But I'm interested in it in these kind of like weird, wonky, well, you know, loan guarantee is not the right way to think about policy, not even an 18th best way to think about policy. And also because, and, you know, I think the jury is out on how hastily this was approved or why this went through. But I mean, this company was like it's like a train wreck. You cannot look away. They had, They were like kids with $535 million, and they kept trying to engineer up the process when it didn't work at lower cost levels. And so, you know, they had whistling. You know, a lot of it has been made about the robots that whistled Disney tunes, which is completely true. They had robots that whistled Disney tunes. Well, the reason they had robots that whistled Disney tunes is these robots are autonomously moving around the plant, ferrying, I guess, materials or solar panels, and the Disney tunes are to warn people that they're in the area. Like, all well and good, but that is not something you install when you're a startup, right? If you haven't made money yet, you don't go to robots that autonomously, you hire people to do this for $5 an hour. You find someone who is not employed, and you have them ferry stuff around the plant. I don't care if it's a clean room. It's got to be cheaper than the Disney whistling robots. Because I know something about those kinds of systems. They are in use, but they're in use by massive multinational firms that have huge profitable operations that they're then automating up to a new level or whatever, right? Like, Cylinder was not at that scale. And they built the stuff to be at that scale before they had the customers to be at that scale. So I'm fascinated and this is, by the way, not something behavior that is limited to people with government loans. Companies often have this. I mean, you heard this a lot with the web companies, right, during the dot-com boom. I remember someone at a VC telling me that he had declined to invest in a company when he saw that they had, like, some awesome skylight and blinds that rotated around with a remote control. And he was like, you're wasting way too much money. I'm not giving you more.
Personal masseuse for every executive.
Exactly. There's people like that. But then there's a bunch of segments. There are libertarians who just want to argue against government loan guarantee programs. And in general, and they really are consistent about this. They also don't want them for, you know, any other kind of power thing. They would be very happy if the Department of Energy mostly went away. And then you have kind of other wonky. So there's the wonks, there's the libertarians, there's the conservatives for whom it's a proxy about subsidies to the environment. And I think that among the kind of the wonks, this is a narrow slice, but yes, there are a lot of people arguing about whether loan guarantees are a good idea and whether the valley of death exists and like. And that's a really healthy, good argument to be having about how you think about this stuff. And also about why the Bush administration signed this thing, because it was like a cheap, you know, I put cheap in scare quotes. It was a nominally cheap way to make a gesture about the environment, which is stupid.
I mean, it's interesting because I think I remember reading a post with a quote from someone from, you know, a solar industry maybe it was even the Solar Industry Energy Association or something along those lines, you know, saying that actually, you know, sort of more important to them in terms of any government support there was a grant program that I think is going to expire as part of the stimulus. But that, you know, I mean, exactly, you know, what are we trying to support here? I mean, I think there's the argument that, you know, maybe the U.S., you know, sort of as it's done with other energy sources and so forth needs to put more money into research and development, making the sort of scientific breakthroughs we need to be able to create more effective solar panels or clean running engines or whatever have you. But I think that sort of gets, you know, I mean, I think the assumption that we need to do that through this one program, this loan guarantee program, whatever else have you, you know, that it all kind of gets lumped together. And I think you're right in terms of, you know, the fact that we're having this debate at all, and that the fact that it isn't this kind of either or choice, you know, either we have government support of clean energy and has to be sort of structured this way, or we just kind of junk the entire thing. I mean, I think there are legitimate questions as to, you know, should the government be putting more money into, you know, creating sort of innovative things, and, you know, to that degree, is it worth the risk, and so on and so forth, and what kind of risk it is. But I mean, I think we need to sort of separate exactly what we're talking about here in terms of what this industry needs and what the government's role in it is to begin with.
Well, we wanted to talk about Europe too, so you want to do the 5 to 10 minute before we close up? We've both been following this pretty closely. I'm really curious on your take. I mean, I'm a Eurosceptic and have been for a long time, not because I hate the EU, just because I think it's so far from an optimal currency union that I never saw how this was going to hang together. But what's your take on it? What's the?
I'm feeling, you know, at this point, it feels like they're just. I mean, all of it is just kind of half measures to try to buy themselves more time. But of course, the question is, you know, more time for what? I feel like the only way, you know, just from the folks I'm talking to, the only way this is going to hang together in anything other than, you know, sort of the shortest term is that if, you know, the EU moves towards having a monetary and fiscal union, that is, that would require kind of choices that I don't think anyone really wants to make. I mean, I think that some folks are still sort of optimistic that can happen, but I feel like, you know, and that would be really the only way that I feel like in the long run that the market and other folks would feel secure in sort of continuing to back this thing. I mean, I think the more likely scenario, you know, seems to be, I mean, and people are sort of talking about all sorts of scenarios along these lines, is that, you know, it'll just be a smaller currency union, and then maybe there'll even be sort of a separation between northern sort of countries and southern countries. I'm not really sure in terms of, you know, whether the euro itself will be the currency they'll center around. But, I mean, you know, everything that they're asking, you know, Greece to do, for example, I mean, it's sort of already becoming clear that they're not going to be able to meet the kind of austerity targets that had been hoped for. I think that those, you know, there's just going to be a big write-down. It's going to be painful, and I'm not sure the degree to which, you know, whether Greece will default, whether it won't. But at this point, it doesn't seem like there's the political will to make, you know, the kind of decisions that would be necessary for this to hold together in anything longer than maybe a couple of months, maybe the next year, but anything beyond that, you know, just given the way the political process has worked so far, I'm feeling kind of skeptical about that myself. So what's your feeling at this point?
Well, I try to imagine, because I want to be wary of my instinct to say, like, it can't hold together. It's going to fall, because it's just none, the math doesn't work. And so I want to, like, push back on that. But I try to imagine, I try to, like, think of the United States is not an optimal currency union either. But the United States has this fiscal, we have a lot of labor market mobility, and we also have, as you know, Europe is talking about doing, we have a huge fiscal union. But if you think about the fiscal union in the U.S., it's really a fairly recent vintage, right? It comes around, you know, whatever date you want to put it on, sometime between 1929 and 1945, or 1913 and 1945, I guess, depending on, you know, really how you want to. But I'd say you can argue that the Federal Reserve was the monetary union in a sense, and that sometime between 1929 and 1945 was the necessary fiscal union. But people already identified as American, right? I mean, the regional identifications were much weaker, which had been very strong at the beginning in, you know, 1803 or whatever. The regional identifications had already faded in most of the country, with the possible exception of the South, compared to someone who identifies as Greek versus German. You know, obviously regional identifications still exist. But also, like, was there any state in 1935 that was as big a basket case as Greece is? Was there any state that had this combination of, like, completely low trust, no one pays their taxes, and also high spending? Because I know that I think Arkansas defaulted on its debt. I actually wrote about this, I should remember. But one state did default on its debts, and it's, as far as I know, the only state default in the 20th century. But they, like, it was a long and complicated process where the state's GDP had, or state, you know, domestic product had totally, had plummeted, and they'd assumed all of this road debt from the road building boom of the 20s, and they just ended up not being able to pay it, and they actually did restructure it and paid most of it back, I think. But is there any country that had, like, I mean, they've got, like, a 20, 30, some crazy percent gap between what citizens expect from the government and what the government can collect in taxes to deliver. I don't understand how Germany can enter fiscal union with that. I just don't get it. right? Like, well, would you agree to enter fiscal union with your brother-in-law who can't hold a job? And I don't mean it's like slam Greece, but they've got a lot of problems. Would you agree to enter fiscal union with your brother-in-law who has enormous financial issues if you didn't? Like, it would be really tough for me to agree to unlimited liability. Like, I might say I'll pay off your old debts, right? But to say, like, I'm going to pay off any debt you choose to accrue? No, not in any way would I put myself on the hook for that.
Yeah, and I think that's basically the sentiment that you've been hearing, you know, mostly from Germany this entire time. And there haven't been, at the same time that obviously you do have leaders like Merkel and others saying, you know, this is a collective problem. If we don't solve this, everyone's going to drag down and so forth. But beyond that, you don't have, you know, the reason that you might put yourself, tie yourself to your brother-in-law and be willing to take on his debt, maybe even take on future debts, is because, you know, you're a member of the same family. And then there's none of that sense of you're not getting, politically speaking, that sort of, you know, well, you know, we're all in this together because we're all, you know, we're all Europeans. We have this sort of transnationalism that, you know, will ultimately serve us better in the long run, that will require us to make painful sacrifices now. But, you know, that kind of sentiment, you're not hearing that. I mean, you're hearing basically nationalist idea, you know, sort of from whether it's from the German parliament or sort of more recently the Finnish parliament. Saying, no, you know, we were responsible. We don't want to take on the responsibilities of other folks who have just not, you know, who've spent too much, too far too much, who haven't been responsible, haven't paid their taxes, and so on and so forth. So, I mean, I think the reason that I might feel more hopeful that kind of, you know, sort of fiscal union with monetary union might be possible is that if you did have at least some folks, you know, a wave of that sentiment, and then the idea that wave, you know, could sort of grow and sort of encompass, grow across other countries. I mean, that was the great hope, right, of this entire project to begin with. But I don't think you're getting that. I mean, I don't think that's what, you know, Sarkozy or Merkel or, you know, anyone is really kind of emphasizing right now. And I think, you know, sort of more broadly speaking, that's why I feel like, you know, I think folks are sort of understandably skeptical of you know, in terms of the long-term project of this, much less, I mean, I don't know. I mean, you have the IMF estimating that, I think it was, you know, that the bailout fund in the, that, you know, needs to be on the order of, you know, $2.7 trillion or something, you know, that very, and then that's just to solve the problem at the moment. I mean, this is not, you know, this is the magnitude of what's needed in their estimation to give the markets enough security to make sure that this current crisis doesn't spill over into a global crisis. But that's you know, just the first step. In terms of being able to take those other steps, I don't feel like politically there is sort of this overarching will to be able to, you know, have the political solidarity needed to, you know, make this a sustainable project in the long run.
I mean, I should say that my brother-in-law is a model of fiscal rectitude, but my personal brother-in-law. But, like, I think this is the counter-argument, right, is, or the counter-argument that people were making, and I feel like they're making it less than they used to, is just that, like, it's so unthinkable. I mean, if Germany doesn't bail out Greece, their banking system is going to go down. The French banking system is probably in worse shape. I mean, these guys have taken on a lot of Greek and Irish and various sovereign debt because the ECB accepts it as collateral, you know, like, and because of the way the capital requirements are worked out, they have a lot of this stuff on their books. I think it was the head of Deutsche Bank in a speech like a month or so ago said it's an open secret that there are a lot of banks in the kind of central countries that are insolvent if Greece defaults in any significant way. And so, like, the thing is, it's unthinkable to let this happen, right? You're going to have these banking systems. Our banking system is about, the assets are about 1x GDP. Their banking systems are in, like, the 2 to 3, I think Switzerland's 5, I think maybe Belgium is also 5, times GDP range. And so if their banking system goes under, can their sovereigns even really handle that problem? It kind of depends on how bad the asset impairment is and various other things. But, you know, the crisis that will be triggered with a really big collapse of the EU is also completely unthinkable. I just, like, so I guess ultimately what I'm looking at is, like, on one hand, the math doesn't work either way anymore. But that politically, as you say, the, you know, ultimately I think because the math doesn't work either way, it's going to end up being decided politically. And politically, I don't see that the will is there in the central countries to bail out people that they don't feel particularly related to.
And I guess
on that happy note,
optimistic note, Europe's going down. We're going down with them.
Yes.
but anyway, it's been great talking to you, Maya.
Yes, as always. And all right. And I'm sure we'll run into each other one of these days as blogger things for pundit people.
Sounds good.
Anyway, farewell, internet.
All right. Bye-bye, everyone.
Bye-bye.